This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. It's the inaugural International Day of Women and Girls in Science today, adopted by the UN to address the continued exclusion of the participation of women and girls in science. According to a study conducted in 14 countries, the probability for female students of graduating with a bachelor's, master's and doctor's degree in science-related fields are 18%, 8% and 2% respectively, while the percentages for male students are 37%, 18%. And 6%. Joining me today is Dr. Mary Suma Cardoza, a consultant anesthesiologist and pain management specialist at Hospital Selayang, who is also the first female president of the Malaysian Medical Association. And she is going to be discussing her career, and we're going to find out if she ever faced gender-based challenges throughout her education and career. Welcome to the show, Dr. Cardoza.
Thank you, Lynn.
Could you tell me a little bit about your childhood and your teenage years? Were you always encouraged towards academic excellence by your family?
Well, encouraged towards academic, I think that was just kind of normal for us, you know. Everybody of course went to school and everybody did their best in school, and so it wasn't like extraordinary, any extra encouragement. It was just normal. I think my mother was really great because she didn't differentiate between girls and boys. We had three girls and three boys in our family. And all the girls and all the boys had to do all the same things. Everybody went to school. Everybody did the house chores. Everybody did everything equally. And so as I was growing up, I didn't feel that there was any difference. You know, and I think that's important. I think that having those gender roles imbibed in you when you are a child and saying you must do this, you can't do that, it really makes a big difference to people.
And did your parents ever encourage you towards medicine, or was it something that you wanted to do?
I did well in school. It was not very difficult for me to get good grades in school. So in those days, in the 70s, if you did well in school, people all expected you to do medicine, right? So I was a little bit of a rebel and I said, no, I'm not going to do medicine because everybody expects me to do medicine. So I decided to follow my sister who had gone to the U.S. to study, and I applied to the U.S. And so I went, after my Form 6, I went to the U.S. But eventually when I spent 2 years in the U.S. and then I decided that medicine was a good thing to do. And so I came back before finishing my undergraduate education in the U.S. I came back to University of Malaya and did my medicine there in UM here.
Was there a singular inspiration at all, you know, in your decision to that medicine was a good thing to do, that this is something that you would like to pursue?
You know, in those days, you're a little bit idealistic and, you know, so what I wanted to do eventually was when somebody asked me, what do you want to do with your life? I said, I want to help people. So if you want to help people, medicine is a good way of helping people. So I decided that, yeah, I'll do it after all.
And once you decided to do medicine, why did you choose to specialize in anesthesiology in particular?
Oh, that's another story. Well, there were a few things. I was actually interested in obstetrics and gynecology. And it was actually because there were not many women in the field. And I thought that's ridiculous, right? There should be more women in obs and gyne. When I was a medical student, there were not many women. So I wanted to do that, and there were two things that stopped me. One was when I was still a student, I told my professor I wanted to do it. And that was when I faced some gender bias, since we're talking about gender bias here. My professor asked me whether I wanted to get married, you know, and I thought that was a ridiculous question because it was totally irrelevant to the choice of your specialty. So I was mad, and not that it stopped me, but when I was in the labor room and when I did my obstetric and gynae posting, I didn't like to see the women in pain, you know. So I decided that I wouldn't be able to do this. So I decided to go into anesthesiology. Anesthesiology is something that is low-key. It is in the background, but it's very important. And only we who are anesthetists know that we are doing an important job. So it doesn't really matter to me. To me, you know, I know that I'm helping the patient. If I wasn't there, the patient wouldn't be able to have their surgery. So doesn't matter whether the surgeons get the glory and, you know, we just work in the background. But that was important to me. The other thing is, I think it's very scientific. You know, we base our practice on, not that medicine is not scientific, but, you know, it's applied physiology and pharmacology. And so whatever we do is very precise. And I like that precision. I also like the fact that you look after somebody very well during a limited period of time. And then after that, you know, don't really have to worry about the patient, because I don't want to get attached to patients, which was one of my problems when I was a young doctor during my younger housemanship and young days as MO.
So your professor said that to you. Were you also, you know, did you ever find yourself being treated differently by your peers? Were there a lot of, you know, back when you were studying medicine, were there more male medical students compared to female medical students?
Yes, when I was in medicine, there were about a third of our class were female. So it was male-dominated, but there was no difference in how we treated each other. I think we all were pretty equal, and we are all still good friends now. And I don't think there's any, among peers, any kind of gender bias. It was just what people's expectations, I think, in those days, you know, that if you are a female, you would do something less stressful, something like that, yeah.
Moving on to now, you're currently the president of the Malaysian Association for the Study of Pain, and I understand you pioneered the development of clinical services, health workforce education, and pain research here in Malaysia. Could you tell us about that work?
So, after I did anesthesia, you have a choice of doing subspecialty. So I was kind of, pain was one of the choices. So I set up the acute pain service in Hospital Kuala Lumpur, where I was working at that time, just to take a step back. When I did my anesthesia training in Australia, and I looked at things that we hadn't developed in Malaysia at that time. This was in the 1990s. So there were two things that we hadn't developed. One was daycare surgery and the other one was acute pain service. And so when I came back, I was interested in both. And so I ended up focusing more on acute pain. So I set up the acute pain service. Then I went to do my pain training, and I continued by setting up pain clinics, which is more of a chronic pain. And then I also helped to set up the palliative care services, which more focuses on pain and symptom management in patients with advanced cancer and other terminal diseases. So I have done a lot of this kind of so-called pioneering work in these areas, and I've trained many people and so on and so forth. And so developing new areas, I think, is one of the challenges that I enjoy.
And some of those nationwide initiatives were, you know, pain as the fifth vital sign, pain-free hospitals. Could you explain, you know, what pain as the fifth vital sign was? I understand why you would choose to focus on this, you know, pain being a specialty of what you do. But what were you aiming to achieve with these sort of nationwide programs?
So pain as the fifth vital sign is actually a movement that was started in the US in the 90s. And then in 2001, the JCO in the US, the accreditation board in the US, adopted it as a fifth vital sign. Fifth vital sign just means that our four vital signs are blood pressure, pulse, respiration, and temperature, and that's what is done on a routine basis. And so what that movement wanted was to make pain assessment a routine thing, because pain can't be seen. So you have to ask a person whether they are in pain in order to know whether they are in pain. You have to know whether somebody is in pain before you can treat the pain, right? So pain as a fifth vital sign is to make pain more visible by making it a routine part of the assessment of patients. So the reason to do this was to, in order to improve pain management on the whole, you have to make it, first you have to make people aware of it and make it more visible. So that was it.
And does the work that you do in the pain subspecialty in the Ministry of Health play a role in making pain more visible and trying to bring pain, I guess, more to the forefront of the work we do in the hospitals and so on?
So this pain as a vital sign program and pain-free hospital program were all done through my work in the Ministry of Health. It was all done through the Ministry of Health. If I was in the university or if I was outside of the in the private sector, I wouldn't be able to do this work. That was one of the reasons why I stayed in Ministry of Health. So, yeah, it is part of my work. I'm head of the pain subspecialty in Ministry of Health. I'm quite a senior anesthesiologist in the Ministry of Health. So, you know, this was part of the work. And basically, you have the whole country, you know, at your feet, in a sense, at your hands. You want to have a program. I piloted it in Hospitals Layang and then looked at some of the impact of the program. And then presented it to the Ministry of Health, and then the Ministry of Health makes it into a policy. So now it's policy for the whole country, all government hospitals in the country, and then private hospitals and university hospitals also adopted it, because of course Ministry of Health is the largest provider of healthcare in the country.
What are some of your areas of research?
Well, I focus on pain, of course. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in some of the aspects of chronic pain management. I run a cognitive behavioral therapy program, a group program, with a clinical psychologist that I work with who's from UPM. And I'm interested to see the impact of this kind of, the outcomes of these programs in our population, because previously they were only run in Western populations. Mm-hmm. They were developed in Western populations. So we were interested to see whether we can use the same methodology in our population or not, whether there's any difference. And basically, it's the same. You know, people with chronic pain are the same all over the world. So we have run those programs quite successfully. So I've done some work on that. Looking at psychological profile of different chronic pain patients in Malaysia, the ones who come to our clinic. And I've also done some epidemiology work on prevalence of pain in Malaysia compared to, of course, because this kind of work has been done in other countries as well. So epidemiology, chronic pain programs, ethnicity, the effect of ethnicity. My work is more clinical, not, you know, hard science kind of, not basic science work. So those are the areas that I'm interested in, I've been working in.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Mary Suma Cardoza, consultant anesthesiologist and pain management specialist at Hospital Selayang. We're discussing, whether or not she's faced gender-based challenges throughout her education and career in conjunction with the International Day of Women and Girls in Science. Up next, we hear about her tenure as the first female president of the Malaysian Medical Association. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. With me in the studio, Dr. Mary Suma Cardoza, consultant anesthesiologist and pain management specialist at Hospital Selayang. And she's joining us because it's the International Day of Women and Girls in Science. So we're celebrating women and girls in science. And Dr. Cardoza, you were the first female president of the Malaysian Medical Association. I understand that at the time, you remember hearing unfavorable comments at your installation. Could you share that story?
I was the first female president. I was also the first female secretary of MMA. MMA is a Malaysian Medical Association. It's a very male-dominated association. And it was around 50 years old, you know, and there hadn't been any women presidents. But for me, it was like a natural transition. I've been involved in the association since I was a houseman. Actually, since I was a medical student, I was a member, and then as a houseman, I was involved in the young doctors section of the association. And then I took a break for quite a long time. Then I came back in and I eventually ended up being the secretary. And then from secretary, I moved on to president. And it was just like, you know, what you do.
Right.
So in terms of unfavorable, I can't really remember what it was. But I know that as a female, I think I have a different style of leadership. And the style of leadership in MMA is very much like what the president says goes, you know.
Very top-down.
Yeah. There is discussion. Of course, there's discussion. But in the end, you have the final say. I didn't like that style of leadership because I have really been very much involved with women's organizations in the past. And I grew up with a different style of leadership, more consultative, more democratic, more collective kind of decision-making, you know. So I want everybody to take part and I want everybody to own the decision. And then, you know, I believe in things like we agree to disagree, we have a discussion and then we agree what's the best decision. And it doesn't matter whether it's my decision or not my decision, you know. But I think that that kind of style, leadership style, is seen as a weakness rather than a strength. And so I had a hard time, put it simply.
And looking at your career as a whole, do you have any observations about the challenges women face that are specific to the medical field? In talking about the Malaysian Medical Association and talking about your education, you've mentioned male-dominated spaces. You know, would that be one of them?
Yeah, certainly. I think now that there are lots of women in medicine, and I think that for a woman to develop her career in medicine and to become a specialist and become top of your field, it's not an issue. Okay, you just have to work hard, just like any man would have to work hard. I think it is more in the leadership of this kind of organizations that the space is still limited. When I was president, I was hoping to have more women leaders develop, you know, the younger women. But there were other issues that took my time, and so I was unable to do this. It was only a one-year term. And today you see the council the same as it was in, you know, before my time, that there are very few women, are 10% or less, you know, of the council, and there's no other woman president in the making that I can see. Maybe, hopefully, there will be in the future as well. But I think that those are the challenges. It's also, I think, partly because women don't prioritize this kind of thing. You know, it's no big deal for us. Family is more of a priority. And the expectation is also that, you know, we will prioritize our families, which is not wrong. But I think that it's up to the individual to make the choice. And really, people shouldn't look at whether, you know, you are female or male in deciding whether you should be a leader or not. You know, but really, in the career of medicine, in developing your career, I don't think there are huge obstacles, except for the fact, of course, that you may want to take some time off to have children and so on and so forth, you know. And now, there is space for this, but it's tough. I think it's tougher for women than for men.
And that's true of many careers. I mean, in many careers, you'd also have to take that time off. So for women now, you know, anything is possible. But for you personally, how did you overcome any gender-related roadblocks in your career? Were there any?
Not anything prominent that I can think of, okay? But I'm single. I don't have, you know, children to worry about. I don't have a husband to hold me back. I shouldn't say that. So I'm just my own person. I only have to look after myself. So I think I'm a little bit different from other women. Maybe people will say, oh, you know, you had to sacrifice your marriage and family for your career. You know, that kind of thing. But to me, it is not really a sacrifice in the sense that, and you know, there wasn't any point in my life where I had to choose between marriage and a career because there wasn't any marriable person in my life, you know. So to me personally, there wasn't any gender-based obstacles, I would say. But I'm different, a little bit different from a lot of other women.
That's in life. But at the workplace, did you ever observe any moments where you felt you were treated differently because of your gender?
Well, I have an experience as a young doctor where I was a houseman doing my orthopedic posting. And it's not really a bad story, but, you know, there was a guy who had something that needed to be done. And so there was me and two nurses. And so we were doing this procedure on this guy, and it was an emergency procedure. And this guy then turned to us and said, oh, now nurses can do everything by yourself. Huh? You don't need doctors. You know, so there's always this thing about people assuming that you are a nurse rather than a doctor, and then sometimes trying to apologize for it, you know. So there is that kind of assumption. Still, I think that people, when I tell people I work in a hospital, they say, oh, you know, you're a nurse, you know, that kind of thing.
Just so, that kind of assumption.
Yeah, that kind of assumption. But it's not bad, I suppose. It's just something that's ingrained in society. So it just shows that people still have not sort of accepted that, you know, women can do everything that men can do.
Earlier you mentioned that, you know, provided you work hard enough, you know, there's really nothing standing in your way. What are some patterns you've noticed over the years about women at work and things that they could be doing better to advance their careers?
I think we need to decide, we need to be focused, okay? So at certain point in your life, you prioritize your family. At certain point in your life, you prioritize your career. And obviously, you do need your family support, your spouse, your partner's support for this. You know that I will do this now, but please give me my time later on. And so when you're focused, when you decide to do something, you need to focus on it. You can't be doing too many things at the same time. I know one of the things that women do is multitask. We are said to be better at multitasking than men, right? So we can do it. We can do it. But you don't achieve, you know, that standard or that standard of excellence if you don't focus on what you do. If you're too, you have too many other things distracting you, you know. It's possible, you know, but it's that level of excellence that you want to achieve. And I think you need to make that decision. So I think that maybe people are distracted and don't unfocus throughout their lives, rather than, you know, you can partition your life and you can decide what you want to do at certain points, different points.
And I would imagine that, you know, there are several possible points of dropout for women in science throughout the path. You know, you could drop out at the school level, you could drop out, you know, when you decide to have a family. From your point of view, what works to keep women in science? Do we need more of a support system?
It would be good to have a support system, but I think that each person actually develops their own support system, whether it is their colleagues, whether it is their family. And I think that in order for women, as well as men, to stay in your career and to keep going, you need some kind of mission, you know, you need a goal. If you have a goal, I think it's easier to keep going because you have something to aim for. And of course, having rewards, you know, seeing the outcomes or seeing things happen because of your work, that always helps. Yeah, I think that along the way, you need to have this, set these little goalposts and then acknowledge when you achieve the goals and then move on to the next one kind of thing, you know, in order not to lose focus and drop out.
In your view, you know, days like the International Day of Women and Girls in Science, are these days that are important to have, you know, or why do we need them around?
Actually, I've never heard of this. You say it's the first.
It's the first, yeah.
It's the first. I've never heard of this. I guess it is good because it will kind of focus people's attention on this issue. You know, the figures you gave in the beginning of the program were pretty appalling, right? I don't know what year that was, and I don't know what kind of changes have been made over the years, but if it's a recent figure, it's pretty shocking to me. So I would say that having these kind of days just opens out the space for discussion of these issues. And so in that way, it is good. It doesn't help individuals maybe, but it's good for awareness because, you know, if individuals want to succeed, I think the whole sort of surroundings also have to move along and change with the times and progress.
We've changed quite a bit from the time that you described of, you know, if you do well at school, then it's medicine for you. You know, now if you do well at school, there's a whole variety, a whole host of things that you could go into. What more can be done to encourage women into the fields of science, technology, engineering and math, where I think overall we're still reasonably underrepresented?
Well, I think role models is important. So showcasing role models for the younger women to say, hey, I can do that, you know. I think also maybe exposure. I'm not sure what it is in the whether, you know, girls are more likely to go into arts stream and stuff like that. It was certainly like that in my day. But so, for example, when I was in Form 6, we only had two science classes and, you know, there was only one girl in the double maths class. And then there were about 10 or 15 of us in the maths, bio maths class, you know. So exposure to these different technical subjects as a student, in school, equally, I think, to boys and girls. You know, now most of the schools are co-ed and, you know, I think children are exposed pretty equally. And so I think that this will help. And then, of course, having opportunities. You know, so maybe some kind of affirmative action, you know, purposely trying to get more girls. I really don't know. In medicine, it's not such a big issue. I think now in medical school, there are more girls than boys. So, but in other areas of science, I think basic science research, you know, maybe this is one of the areas that can be encouraged.
While we're talking about role modelling, what words of encouragement would you have for women wishing to pursue a career in science and, you know, specifically medicine?
Well, I think it doesn't matter whether you're a girl or boy. You have to work hard. You can't depend on your on having concessions just because you're a female. I don't think we should be given, you know, we should be given or expect any kind of concessions. So just do what you want to do. And if you like it, go for it, I would say.
The Malaysian Medical Association, the MMA, they're organising a seminar on women empowerment next Saturday. Could you give me more details on the speakers and topics that are going to be covered?
Okay, so this is the Women Empowerment Seminar, which is the first time MMA is organising this. And it's part of their Towards Excellence series. So it's on the 20th of February in the Sheraton Imperial Hotel in KL, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And the speakers are Tan Sri Rafida Aziz. She's the last but not least, of course, speaker. We also have Dr. Kyung Ah Park, who's the president of the Medical Women's International Association. She's a Korean woman, obviously from the name, who is an anatomy professor. And she will be speaking about work-life balance. And then there is me, and then there is Dr. Gayatri from Kedah, who is a psychiatrist. So we have medical and non-medical people. And the topics are, I mentioned work-life balance, celebrating the achievements of women and looking into the future, gender equality benefits men too, and leadership. Male Champions for Change, which is the topic for Tan Sri Rafida Aziz. For more information, you can go to the MMA website, which is www.mma.org.my, and you look for the Excellence Series, and then you will find this seminar. Or contact the MMA at 03-4041-1375 and ask for Miss Rafika. So that's the those are the details of the seminar that we're having. We hope that it's open to the public, MMA members and to the public. There is a registration fee, but there are 50, the first 50 MMA members who register will get it for free or something like that. Will get their registration fee waived. So do come and listen to us. And be inspired.
Again, that website, for more information on the Women Empowerment Seminar, you can visit mma.org.my. Thank you very much for coming in, Dr. Cardoza. I've been speaking with Dr. Mary Suma Cardoza, consultant anesthesiologist and pain management specialist at Hospital Selayang. Together, we've been discussing really just women in medicine and how to get them and keep them. In conjunction with the International Day of Women and Girls in Science, you've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.